Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, Assistant Professor of Communication and Media at Loon University. Remember, you can follow the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web at socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. As Joe Biden is settling in as president of the United States, we're going to take this episode and look at some research done by a key player that helped get him elected, and that is Priorities USA. They are the largest Democratic Party super PAC and have done a lot of research, not just this election cycle, but in previous years, trying to understand the effectiveness of digital ads and how to use digital ads to increase voter turnout and support for Democratic candidates. And my guest today is Nick Ahmed. He is the director of analytics at Priorities USA and has done a ton of research focusing on randomized field experiments and also survey experiments to understand the persuasion and mobilization effectiveness of political ads. And so, what type of scale are we talking about here? In the 2020 election cycle alone, Priorities USA spent over $150 million on ad buys across TV, radio, and digital, and tested 492 ads in randomized controlled trials. And what we're going to talk about in this episode is particularly digital and experiments that Priorities has been running going back to 2018 to find out first, do digital ads work in increasing mobilization and persuasion? And then, how does that differ across different messaging types, different targeting approaches, and different lengths of ad treatments? And so we'll get into that, and I think it's really interesting because not only does it shed some light where academic research hasn't really caught up to yet, but what's really interesting about the type of work that Nick does is that they're testing these ads during campaigns when the stakes are high, not in a laboratory setting outside of a campaign context. So in this episode, Nick's going to share some of his findings about what Priorities USA has found to be effective in increasing voter turnout and support for Democratic candidates. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Nick Ahmed. Again, he's a director of analytics at Priorities USA. Nick, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Awesome. Great to be here. Excited to chat with you today.
So before we dive into the ins and outs of randomized field experiments, can you give the listeners a bit of an introduction into Priorities USA and the type of work that you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Priorities USA Action is a super PAC, which basically means that we raise and spend large amounts of money on elections in the US. We're primarily known for being sort of the presidential PAC, spending most of our money in presidential elections. We were active in 12 for Obama and 16 for Hillary, and then most recently in 2020 for Joe Biden. But in addition to being one of the sort of largest outside spenders, we're also the coordination hub for other PACs spending in the presidential, ensuring that Democrats on the outside are spending as efficiently and effectively as possible. And for me as the analytics director, what that means is providing resources like targeting models and research like that we're going to discuss today to equip partners to run the best program possible.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is that there's not so much academic research on the topic. And I think that the work that you're doing really fills in that niche. And so starting in 2018, Priorities sought to explore whether digital advertising was an effective way to increase voter turnout and support for Democratic candidates. And since then, you've run a number of field experiments testing the effect of digital ads on mobilization and persuasion. But before we get into a few specific examples, can you outline for the listeners what exactly a field experiment is and your approach to designing them at Priorities?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think one thing I would note is that in addition to being sort of the largest outside spender on the Democratic side, we have a particular focus in digital advertising at Priorities. A lot of what you'll see from super PACs is that they just spend huge amounts of money on TV ads. Just to give some context, we spent $153 million on ads in the 2020 cycle. $133 million of that was on the presidential, $20 million was on the Senate. And exactly half of what was on the presidential was on digital platforms like Facebook and Google, the other half being on TV and radio. So with digital ads, we want to make sure that we're being as effective as possible. And so, like you said, we do all sorts of testing, field experiments, survey experiments, et cetera. Field experiments are the gold standard for us. And in our context, a field experiment is opposed to a survey experiment. It's conducted outside of a specifically designed survey environment or instrument. And usually that means a normal advertising campaign with some sort of randomization in it, and then observing political behavior like voter turnout or candidate support. In terms of our approach to designing them, I think there are several factors we consider. So the first one, or an important one, is at what level do you randomize? So you have several options. You could randomize at the individual level, randomizing voters on the voter file to say this person is going to get treatment X, this person's going to get treatment Y, this person's going to get the control. Another factor is what is the behavior you're trying to measure? So turnout, for example, you can observe on the voter file. We get validated vote history months after an election, and we can see X person voted, Y person didn't. But for something like persuasion, you never, you know, whether or not you vote is public record, but for whom you vote is always secret. And so we can't just look in a database to say, oh, this person voted for Joe Biden. We need to either use surveys or precinct results to measure candidate support. Those are probably some of the two biggest factors we consider when designing an experiment, and that affects everything else. I think a third one I would say is how easy or difficult is it for the media buying department to implement an experiment? And I think we'll talk about this a little bit later, but you can't always measure everything that you want to. So what are the sort of key factors that are important to measuring? And do the platforms that you are trying to measure allow for those? So for example, if you want to do an individually randomized experiment to measure turnout, it's important to know that Google does not allow you to do individual level targeting anymore. So you're automatically blocking off like a third of the advertising landscape from what you can measure. And then you have to ask questions about the sort of external validity of your experiment.
Right. And before we get into some of the concrete examples that you've been working with over the past couple of years, I wanted to ask, how do you decide what to test? Because, I mean, the advantage of experimental designs is that you can kind of isolate and test one specific variable, but the disadvantage is you don't want to add too many variables to your experiment because then you kind of lose control over that specific thing you're looking for. So how do you zero in on exactly what you'd like to test for each experiment?
Yeah, it's a really good and a really hard question. We go back a lot. And when I say we, it's really me and our paid media director and our integrated media director. So the people who are designing our sort of actual media plans. The goal, whenever the analytics team designs and implements an experiment, it's to set up those teams with the best evidence or the evidence for the best strategies possible. And so, you know, we go to them and say, what are the questions that you wish you had information on? And then we narrow down to say, what do we think we're actually going to be able to answer? What do we think the effect of a strategy is going to be to make sure that we have sort of a viable, you know, that the experiment would be able to detect such an effect? And like I said, like if you're doing an individual randomized experiment, you can randomize hundreds of thousands of individuals. But a lot of times we do zip code randomized experiments because you can run them on a lot more platforms. Almost every platform allows for zip code targeting. But there are only, you know, 2,000 zip codes across some of our states. So you're a lot more limited on sample size and statistical power. I think the other thing that I would add is that we think a lot about the shelf life of our research. And by shelf life, I mean, we try to avoid doing research on questions that might be moot in a few years. So for example, in 2018 or 2019, we could have asked, what effect do Spotify ads have on voter turnout? Interrupting your podcast or your music, telling you to vote. But then Spotify blocked political ads. So that research would have no longer been relevant. Instead, we try to ask questions like, what effect do internet audio ads have on voter turnout? And that question remains relevant because there's usually a platform that will allow political ads.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, obviously, the ad rules are changing all the time. So it's cool to get at some more kind of fundamental questions.
Yeah, exactly.
And so getting into some of the findings here, what I gathered from Priorities USA's presentation at the DNC Digital Debrief was that the kind of general approach to studying the effectiveness of these ads was to see whether first digital ads work, and then after kind of proving that out, getting into some more fine-grained aspects, like what are the best messaging strategies, targeting approaches, time lengths to run an ad, et cetera. And we'll get into all that, but first, you had to kind of show that digital ads were effective in the first place. So can you walk us through the experiments you conducted in 2018 in terms of what did you use as treatments, for example, and what were the main findings?
Yeah, absolutely. First, at a high level, that sort of framework is right. So we came out of the 2016 cycle. Our leadership sort of perceived that the biggest gap between Democratic and Republican campaigns was on digital advertising. And so in the 4 years between 16 and 20, we wanted to have an order of magnitude increase in the Democratic Party's ability to run effective digital ads. And a lot of that is training staff, running program ourselves, but then a lot of it was building up the research base that, like you said, isn't there on the academic side. You know, figure out what are the best practices to tell other campaigns. And a lot of the research that had already been done, we wouldn't describe as digital first. It was taking a TV ad and putting it on YouTube, or taking a GeoTV mailer and turning it into a banner ad. And they weren't really that effective. And so we wanted to say, what is sort of, if we take a digital first approach and we empower a digital team to run the, you know, the most effective program possible, what effect does that have? And so I think we ran three main experiments in 2018 that were set up to inform our 2019 and 2020 work. The first one is, I think, my favorite, and it's what we call our self-serve program. So we took two fellows. These were people who had no prior experience in running digital ad programs, but wanted to develop it. We gave them 3 to 4 weeks of training, which is a lot. And we gave them each $50,000 to spend in a congressional race. They were safe races, which I think is important to note. It was the California 7th and the Wisconsin 5th. And we were the largest spender, which, again, is important to note because of the external validity of, you know, a safe race where no one else is really spending does not necessarily hold to a presidential election. But we wanted to say, take two people with basic training, with a good amount of money, and we ran precinct randomized persuasion campaigns. And the effect of those was to increase support for the Democratic candidate by 0.6%. And that might not seem like a huge effect. Well, I think substantively it is when you think about, you know, how close a lot of races are, especially like thinking about some of the states in 2020 in the presidential. But you also need to take into account the cost of things, right? So a TV ad campaign is incredibly expensive. So we translate things into cost per vote or votes per $1,000 spent. And that experiment resulted in a cost per vote of $38, which is really comparable to what you see in other voter contact methods. So that was one experiment. Another experiment we did was on a much larger scale, working on 44 of the most competitive House races and 5 of the most competitive Senate races. And it was just to say, does starting earlier with persuasion have a larger effect than starting later with persuasion? Earlier for us meant July of 2018. And that's in comparison to later, which is after Labor Day 2018. Labor Day is the usual day that sort of big persuasion campaigns tend to kick off in campaigns. And so we wanted to say, if you start earlier, does that have an additive effect or does all of that decay? And you can see how that sort of might set up our 2019 and 2020 work on the presidential. And the result there was that starting earlier led to a 0.4 percentage point increase in support for the Democratic candidate than starting later. And I think, you know, you can't necessarily compare the 0.4 and 0.6 because we were spending considerably more money on those House and Senate races than we were in the self-serve program. But at least some of the effect did not decay, which is really was really important for us to know. The third one was about turnout. And turnout in some senses is the easiest to measure because you can see whether or not someone voted. But it can also be really difficult to measure. And basically, no past research had demonstrated that digital ad campaigns could have a positive effect or a significant effect on voter turnout. And so ours did have a substantive increase in turnout. I think it was about 0.25 point, but it was not statistically significant. And so we decided we need to do additional follow-up research there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting because I remember watching your presentation. I remember seeing some numbers that were about that 0.5 to 1 percent range, but I didn't know if those were like effect sizes or overall increase in turnout. And so you sort of answered this question already, but could you put into perspective kind of how effective digital ads appear to be relative to other forms of voter contact?
Yeah, I think it... I wish there was an easy answer to say like, oh, they rank third or something like that. But it really depends on what everyone else in the environment is doing and the context of your race. So say you're running a congressional campaign in Los Angeles, digital is going to be significantly more effective than television because the cost of running a television ad in Los Angeles is incredibly high. And a large portion of the people who are going to see your television ad are not going to live in your congressional district. But say, take another district, I don't have one off the top of my head, that lines up pretty well with the TV media market it's in. TV might be a little bit more effective there. I think we also tend to see diminishing marginal returns. So if a lot of people are running digital ads already, then digital, you adding your digital ad might not be the most effective thing you can do. So I think from our perspective, you need all of the above. You need to do field, you need to do mail, you need to do TV, and you need to do digital. And as an outside group, we try to see what everyone else is doing and then slot in what we think would be most effective on top of that. In a lot of the cases, we've seen that the gap was on digital. And so for us, digital was the most effective voter contact method to add to the ecosystem.
Right. And it does kind of align, because there is some academic research that's been done in partnership with platforms. There's the Bond et al. Study from 2012 that used Facebook, I voted, and social pressure messaging to increase turnout, the 61 million person experiment. And I think for them, it was about, 0.29% or something increase in voter turnout was their estimate, which sort of aligns with the numbers that you're saying.
Yeah.
But if you, their argument was that if you extrapolate that, what that percentage means in terms of the population they targeted, it's something like a 300,000 person increase in turnout. So maybe it's not so much the size of the effect, but maybe also the scale of the effect.
Yeah, I think both of those things are important. So I like to talk about it in terms of significant effects. Obviously, I mean, we can talk about p-values, but it's, you know, even leadership and political organizations knows what a 0.05 significance means these days. But I like to talk in terms of substantive effects. So if we had this effect, you know, what does that actually mean for the outcome of the election? And usually academics don't want to, you know, influence things like the outcome of an election, but obviously we do. And so we talk in terms of both, you know, statistical significance and also substantive significance.
Definitely. And moving a bit more into some of the fine-grained aspects that you were testing, sort of after seeing these originally statistically significant effects in 2018, you also conducted an experiment in 2019 around municipal elections in Florida and Michigan, and those were aimed at testing different types of ad messaging as well as different lengths of treatment to these digital ads. So what were the main variables you were testing there, and which one seemed to perform best?
Yeah, so like I said, coming out of 2018, we still had some questions around mobilization and thought we could do, you know, refine more before we got to 2020. One of the things that we did in 2018 was try to measure 2, 4, and 6 weeks of GOTV ads. And we found that 4 weeks is more effective than 2 weeks, and both were positive, but that 6 weeks actually had a slightly negative effect, not statistically significant, but negative. And that just didn't make sense to us. The reason that we were varying the weeks is that unlike field or mail, on digital platforms, it can take time to match and serve ads to someone. So you upload a list of people to target to Facebook, and you then have to go through an auction process. You have to say, I want to target this person. They need to go onto Facebook, scroll past an ad placement, and you need to win the bid on serving that ad there. So it can take a long period of time, up as, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to reach 100% of your matched audience. That means if you start your GOTV 2 weeks before election day, you might not win those bids on those people, minimizing your effect. So we wanted to say, if we start earlier and allow more time for that process, allow more time for treatment, if you will, then maybe we'll have a larger effect size. Like I said, 4 weeks was more effective than 2 weeks, but 6 weeks was negative, and that just didn't square with our priors. So in one set of experiments in 2019, we tried to replicate that and said, if we do 4 or 8 weeks, which will be more effective? You know, ruling out the 2 week based off the 2018 experiment. And I should note, we did this in two ways. One of the questions, you know, I said earlier on the persuasion side, we tested starting earlier. We didn't control for the amount of money that was being spent. So if we started in the zip codes where we started running earlier, we also spent more money. So we tried to take that sort of aspect and put in the mobilization experiment and ran two different ones. One where we said, we're going to run X amount of money for 4 weeks and then X times two across 8 weeks. And then we did a separate one where we said, we're going to run X amount of money in 4 weeks and just X amount of money in 8 weeks. Does that difference make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
And what we found is that 4 weeks is sort of the optimal amount of time. You know, whether you spend twice as much money, the same amount of money across 8 weeks, that effect decays. Beyond 4 weeks, it doesn't have an additive effect on voter turnout, and that 4 weeks was the optimal length for a program. We also had some questions about message. And we don't usually measure message in field experiments. And the reason for that is sort of twofold. First, it's incredibly expensive to produce a full suite of ads for online platforms. This is one big difference between TV and digital ads. TV, you need one 30-second spot usually. For digital, you need audio, banner, video, GIFs, links, and whatnot on Facebook. There's a whole bunch of just different content you need. And so it can be expensive to produce a bunch of these different ones. And then we're always worried about some risk of backlash, that the ads we produce that are untested might produce the opposite effect. And so it can be relatively risky to go run and show these ads to people without knowing ahead of time that they're going to have the intended effect. And the question is just measuring how big of an effect it was. But it's difficult to do messaging survey experiments for GeoTV because people's self-reported intent to vote is not a particularly good indicator of whether or not they're going to vote. Like something like 60 to 80% of people say that they're definitely going to vote in our surveys, but obviously voter turnout is not that high. And so you're automatically not able to measure those people who are lying about or misrepresenting, I should say, their intent to vote. So we try to do a little bit more messaging on the GeoTV side and field experiments. With this experiment, we tried three different GeoTV messages. One is what we would call tactical GeoTV or social pressure that tries to say, you know, your neighbors know whether or not you're going to vote and are depending on you to vote. There's some question about or theory in the digital democratic space that that might not work as well online as it does in mail, because people perceive that sort of targeting as creepy online, that you can't do the same personalization like you can do in mail, and that you can't sort of create the same exact faux governmental style. And so there was a hypothesis that that would not work as well. So we tried that. We tried something that was more motivation-y, like your vote matters, your vote will make an impact, you're prepared to vote, you're qualified to vote, sort of hype messaging. And then a third strategy, which we call check your registration status, that it was sort of my hypothesis that voting is habit forming. And it's about taking actions that build the habit of voting, which is what I did my graduate research on. And the idea is if you can get someone to go to a Secretary of State website to either check if they're registered at their address or register or re-register, whatever it is, that action builds the identity of becoming a voter. And so we tested out these three different message lanes, and we found that the traditional social pressure or digital first social pressure, you might call it, and the check your registration status were both statistically significantly effective. The sort of range of the effect was between 0.2 and 0.3 percentage points. And the motivation message was also effective, but not as much and not statistically significant.
So interesting. I have so many questions for you, but I also have other questions I want to get to. But following up on this, particularly about the time range between 4 and 8 weeks, and I think it's interesting about how this, the time it takes for the delivery to kick in is something quite interesting. So thinking about 4 weeks as the optimal kind of time frame, are you retargeting people or are you only sending them a message once? Like, is perhaps 8 weeks less effective than 4 weeks because people are getting saturated with repeat ads? Or is it maybe just too far ahead of the election cycle? Or what do you think explains that difference between 4 and 8 weeks?
We are retargeting people. So, you know, it depends on the campaign and our budget, but usually we have a frequency of something like 6 to 10 impressions per week over the course of a campaign. With GeoTV, that builds, where they're getting a lot more impressions closer to the election. I don't know. There's other evidence in the ecosphere that GeoTV decays quicker than persuasion. I don't have a strong theoretical reason for it, but one hypothesis might be that people just aren't thinking about the act of voting yet, and so the ad falls flat. Whereas for persuasion, we think these effects last a little bit longer. They are thinking about who they're going to vote for. They're hearing about Joe Biden. They're hearing about Donald Trump. And so you're injecting something into that conversation. Whereas, you know, 2 months out, they're not thinking, okay, November 3rd is election day. How am I going to get to the polling place? And that's not relevant really to their life yet. Whereas within 4 weeks, especially in a context where there's vote by mail or early voting, they are starting to think about, okay, You know, am I going to be in town that weekend? Do I need to, you know, vote by mail early or request my ballot earlier or something like that?
And the other question I had was about cost. And I think it's quite an interesting point you raise about digital being expensive because there's so many different types of creative that you can do, right? Videos, images, GIFs, whatever it is. And we usually think about television as kind of being like de facto more expensive because you need a production team and everything, which is obviously limited by Corona. But is it, you know, in your experience, having worked with these ads, that digital can actually be cost inhibitive?
I don't think it has to be. So I think one, it's cheaper. The barrier to entry for running a digital ad is less than running a TV ad, right? Just because the actual cost of the media is cheaper on digital than it is on TV. And you can be a little bit more targeted, and we can talk about targeting approaches and who you're serving to. So there's some efficiency gains there. But like I was saying, you know, earlier, that was really the purpose of our self-serve experiment. Like, we ran $150 million of ads. We had a whole in-suite team of creatives to write, produce, edit, et cetera, all of those ads. So that's, I think, for us, you know, when we think about testing out a message lane, it's a opportunity cost problem where we could have them focusing on other things. We already have those people, though, and so it's just a trade-off. What the self-serve experiment really tried to say is you don't need to have those things to be effective on digital. So like I said, we took these fellows, gave them 4 months of training. I think total, they spent about $18 on creative. It was just some stock images that they purchased or licensed, I should say. And they shot everything else on their iPhone. They used free editing softwares online to produce all of their ads. And that was the experiment that resulted in a 0.6 point increase in support for the Democratic candidate. So I think you can have the full range of something that someone shoots on their iPhone in an office with relatively little training. And you can have, you know, 15 to 30 people building out videos and everything like that as well.
Yeah, I'm sort of jealous. That sounds like a pretty fun project. And picking up on something that you mentioned before or just now, which was targeting approaches. The last mobilization experiment I like to discuss is exactly about that, which I think is really interesting, where you looked at in the 2019 elections in Pennsylvania and Virginia, you varied ad targeting approaches between first-party targeting versus in-platform targeting. So could you describe what those two different targeting approaches are and what you found out about them?
Yeah, and we actually had a third one, which was just geographic targeting, which was just blanketing an entire zip code. For this experiment, it was zip code randomized, and we had to do that to allow us to test these different targeting options. For first party, what that means is I'm uploading a list of individuals to Facebook and saying, I want you to find these individuals on your platform and serve ads to them. That's what a lot of has been done online in the Democratic space in the past, because you can use your scores that your models that you build. So say we're going to focus on people who have between a 30 and a 60% chance of voting according to the voter file. You can focus on partisans to say, like, I only want to turn out Democrats. And because it's mobilization, you can measure, you can observe whether or not they vote. And so you can, it's just really easy to design and execute experiments. But there are limiting factors. You have match rates. So not everyone who's on the voter file is on Facebook, and Facebook can't perfectly match them. So, you know, somewhere between, depending on the quality of your data, maybe 30 to 70 is a pretty broad range. Percent of the people who are on your list are going to get served ads on Facebook. So if you start with 100,000 people, but only 30,000 of them or 40,000 of them are going to actually see ads, you're minimizing the effect that you can actually observe, because you're still measuring among those total 100,000. You don't know which 30,000 are actually getting served ads. So we wanted to say first party targeting is sort of the bread and butter of what's been done in the past. What do other targeting approaches add? For in-platform, we tried things like, you know, people who are a fan of a certain page or something like that on Facebook. It's demographic targeting. I think, you know, for a lot of our work at Priorities, we want to make sure that we're turning out Black and brown people, that we're turning out young people. And so there are relatively good demographic cues on digital platforms that allow you to do that. And then the other one that I think is sort of innovative and is different than what some people do is using lookalike modeling. This is particularly a tool on Facebook. But we say, here's 3,000 people who are really representative of the kind of people that we want to reach. Go find us more people like that on your platform. And so we could find the 3,000 people on the voter file who we say, like, this is the core of our audience, and then allow Facebook to build a model around that and target more people. Then the third one, like I said at the top, was geographic targeting, saying we're just going to target the entire zip code. We don't do that for every zip code. We want to make sure that we think it's going to be net positive for us, that there are more Democrats than Republicans, essentially. But we found is that the in-platform targeting was really effective, and that the tools that the platforms have are good at finding, you know, ideal targets for us, which are low turnout Democrats, essentially. You have to use them effectively. It's not like every platform targeting option is going to be effective for every purpose. But a well sort of constructed digital media plan that relies on the tools of the platforms can have a particular, you know, a pretty positive effect. I think it was like three times more effective than in-person or first party targeting.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because it really, for me at least, highlights the real market value of these platforms and their targeting services really do work. And so I wanted to ask you about, as you mentioned, most of what we think about, at least from like 2016, is this kind of first party targeting, uploading your list and trying to match those people to their Facebook profiles. But I wanted to ask about, you know, when you're doing in-platform targeting, what's the relationship between kind of campaign collected data and the type of in-platform targeting you're doing? Because as you mentioned, you kind of have to tell the platforms what to use their targeting services for. So how do you see the value of the input data coming from polling or campaigns or some creative idea and the kind of automation side from the platforms in finding those lookalike audiences, for example?
Yeah, let's talk about this in the persuasion context because I think it's a little bit clearer. There are lots of ways to come up with what a persuasion audience is for a campaign. You could do it if you're an actual campaign, you could do it through, you know, in a non-COVID context, door-to-door contact where you're canvassing people, people are telling you that they're undecided. You come up with a list of people who are not yet decided in the campaign and you can tell Facebook, find me more people like that and serve them ads about my candidate. You could do it in a polling context. Who are the people who, when exposed to a message, switch, or in a survey, you know, say they're undecided? The way that we do it is we run survey experiments with different ads, and then we build models to say, here's how persuaded we think this person is by this ad. And I think this is relatively nuanced, so I'll try to, you know, stop me if it's not clear.
Okay.
The reason that we do this in surveys is that you can ask a lot of questions of someone that get at their persuadability. And then you can build your model within that, and you have really good predictors for how persuadable someone is. It took us a long time in our consulting firm, a long time to build up what is a good question for measuring persuadability. But you don't, the way that Democrats traditionally do that is then build that model on their voter file and then predict it onto the voter file and first party target off the voter file. The voter file doesn't have particularly good indicators for persuasion. Some states have party registration, or they record the primary, you know, if you voted the Democratic Party or the Republican primary, and those are good indicators of whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, but they're not a good indicator of whether you're persuadable. My state, my home state, Minnesota, doesn't have either of those. And so you're just relying on things like race, age, gender, et cetera, to predict how persuadable someone is. And that's not a particularly good indicator. And so doing it in the survey context, you get to ask all these extra questions that might measure whether or not someone's persuadable. You can then build a model within the people who took your survey. And you know, we have a couple thousand people who take our surveys, then upload that model to Facebook of 3,000 people and say, find me more people like that. And so for me, that's like the core advantage of the platforms, is that they actually have variables or predictors or whatever you want to call them that are useful at building models for persuasion. They know that I like the DNC and Barack Obama on Facebook, whereas the voter file does not know that. It doesn't know whether I'm a Democrat or not, you know, like I said.
Right. But doesn't it still, so it does have this richer data the platforms do, but doesn't it still attempt to draw some correlations based on what's available in the voter file? These sort of generic socioeconomic status type of variables?
What do you mean? Can you restate that?
Yeah, so like if you upload a voter file complemented with the survey data to get that persuasive aspect, when you're uploading that and asking a platform to do a lookalike audience, it's using its own data, but it's still trying to draw correlations with what you input to it. And if the voter file is bad, then it's just boiling down to kind of race, gender, those types of things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I think that survey data supplement is key. And that we can hopefully get at a lot of the biases and limitations of our file by just asking questions on surveys.
Right. So you're adding a kind of an extra layer to the voter file that then the platform can use apparently very effectively.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting. So speaking of platforms and the output data they give you in terms of these key performance indicators or KPIs, you know, that can kind of tell you how well an ad is performing by all these various platform metrics that I think people are generally increasingly skeptical of. And you examined how well these KPIs stacked up with the results of some of your experiments. So what were some of the KPIs you tested against your findings and how well did they tend to stack up?
Yeah, so, you know, like you said, platforms will give you a variety of metrics, things like video completion rate. I'm going to set that one aside, but and we can discuss it more, but things like clicks on Facebook, you know, likes, hearts, the ha-has, all of those sort of reactions, shares. So is this person sharing this? On other platforms, a lot of what you get is just impressions. How many times was this ad served? But we really drilled in on Facebook. The other one that is sort of a little bit different, I'll say, is YouTube and Google, and that they have a tool that is built into their ad serving platform called BrandLift that actually allows you to do randomized experiments on your ads. And they have some limitations on the questions you can ask in a political context, but you can actually administer a survey that gets at things like candidate support or candidate favorability and measure lift in that, which is a bit different. But for most of the platforms, it's just basic metrics that are really designed around corporate conversions. So driving someone to a site that you can then measure their purchase on, or whether, you know, like I said, they're sharing or reacting to a post.
Yeah, it's. I think in a sense, academics are guilty of this as well, right? Because a lot of the studies are built around, you know, what drives retweets or what drives the number of likes is seen as a measure of success. But you've done some research testing some of the ads or highly successful ads from the Lincoln Project and ran some experiments around those and basically found a negative correlation between persuasion and the amount of engagement or quote unquote virality that these ads have. So what does that say about political persuasion messaging on social media in relation to engagement? Is the focus on engagement perhaps overstated?
Yeah. So we came at this question two different ways, one of which has been written about online, but I think neither are totally perfect studies, but I think together tell a pretty cohesive result. The first one, like you said, is the study of the Lincoln Project ads. We took five ads that were all pretty viral on Twitter. I think one of the least retweets had like 10 or 11,000 retweets. And the one that had the most had something like 200,000 or that might be retweets and comments combined. But, you know, very viral, but a range of virality. We ran those ads in a survey experiment. So not a field experiment, where the survey experiment I talked a little bit about just now, but, you know, we asked them a set of questions. The respondent survey respondents, this is all online panel research. We randomize which ad they see or control group, and then we administer survey questions that, you know, get at the things that we care about. So which candidate are you going to support in the election in the fall? Are you going to vote? Do you approve or disapprove of the job that Donald Trump is doing? That sort of thing. And then a whole suite of sort of demographic, et cetera, questions at the end that, again, we think measure persuasion or help predict persuasion, rather. So what we found, all of their ads had positive persuasion effects, which is good. But the ad that was the most viral had the least persuasion effect. I think the ad that was the least viral had the most persuasion effect. The correlation was negative 0.3. So not as strongly negative as you might think, but still negative. And I think what's going on there is that persuasion, I like to think of a little bit like cough medicine, in that you're changing someone's mind, but they don't like it as it goes down. what a retweet or a like or all of those behaviors indicate is that the person agrees with it. And so if someone's spreading that online, it's probably not because they just had their mind changed, but because it confirms what they already believe. So you have a decent amount, you know, the more positive reinforcement that the ad gets online, that's not necessarily indicating that people are persuaded, but that people already agree with it. The correlation was a little bit lower than I expected, just because I do think there's a little bit of randomness in what goes viral in the first place. So that was one study. The second study we did, obviously only five ads, but the second study we did looked at about 80 ads that we had all, again, tested in the survey experiment context over the course of the 2020 campaign that were usually some of the top performing ads in their survey experiment. So there's a selection bias there, but that we chose to put on to Facebook in actual ad campaigns. We select ads for a variety of reasons and a variety of contexts. And so there's a decent amount of variation in how persuasive these ads were. And then we measured the sort of Facebook KPIs that you get out of the platform per dollar spent on the ad. And we found essentially no correlation between any of those indicators on Facebook and how persuasive the ad was online. Our takeaway from that is that you need to be sure before you put your ad on the internet that it's going to have the intended effect, whether that's persuasion or mobilization, because you can't just reward the quote unquote high performing ads according to the platform KPIs.
Mm. And you know, I've been reading a little bit about the experiments you've been running. And was this the same one that the only correlation for ad persuasion that was consistent was being about the coronavirus?
Yeah, so that was, it was all sort of our big end of year or end of cycle meta-analysis. We looked at all, we tested in total just shy of 500 ads over the course of the cycle. Our measurement team coded them in, I think, you know, 50 different ways on the tone of the ad, is a positive, negative contrast, the imagery, the messaging, the style, was it animated? Did it feature news anchors, that sort of thing? The only one of the 50 attributes that predicted in a statistically significant way the persuasion impact of the ad was whether or not the message was about coronavirus. And, you know, I think, you know, that's not to say that other things don't matter. I think they do, but the ads, creative execution, so again, like the style of the ad, the message of the ad, and the moment that the viewer is seeing it, all need to line up for it to be an effective ad. Mm.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I have two last questions for you. One just kind of popped into my head, which is, you know, we've been talking a lot about persuasion ads and mobilization ads. And I think academics studying campaigning also divide these into categories. But do you see them as two distinct types of ads, or is there not a component of adding persuasion in order to achieve mobilization? Or do you see them as kind of exclusive or complementing each other?
It's a great question. And I think it's something that we in industry go back and forth on all the time. I think the truth is that there is it's a scale, and the words matter, right? When you're talking about mobilization, really what you're talking about is persuading someone to vote. Not vote for a specific candidate. I think you focus on persuading people to vote who already support your candidate. But there's always impacts to both of them. I think, you know, one thing that we see sometimes is that our mobilization ads, because they don't focus on that candidate, don't have much of a persuasion impact. But that's not always true. In fact, some of our most effective quote unquote mobilization ads gave people a reason why they should vote, and that they're, you know, the candidates will have an impact on their lives and their neighbors' lives and their families' lives. And those had both a pretty strong persuasion and a pretty strong mobilization impact. With persuasion, the reverse is not always true. And I think that goes back sort of to the KPIs conversation, in that if you're planning on voting and you're planning on voting for Donald Trump, and then all of a sudden you've had an intervention, an ad intervention that changes your mind who you're going to vote for, you might not be super enthusiastic about voting. There might be a middle ground that says, like, well, I'm not sure who I'm going to vote for, so I'm not sure if I'm going to vote. That's not true for everyone, but there's some people who get persuaded out of voting because they no longer support a candidate. And so persuasion can sometimes have negative effects on vote intent or vote likelihood. We saw that a little bit less, actually, in the year 2020, which is interesting, than we did in 2018 or in past research I've done. And I think that was just because there was, I mean, voter turnout was so high this year that people were just like, I'm going to cast my ballot in this really important election.
Right. So my last question for you, maybe this follows up a bit on what you were just saying, is that you've done all this interesting work around the effectiveness of digital ads in a way that is, I think, really useful for researchers to know about. And so I'm curious to hear, you know, what are some of the key limitations you come across when conducting these studies? I think for academics, it's usually, you know, resources, and it seems that Priorities USA has that covered. So what are the key limitations that you come across in your work? And if those limitations were removed, what would be the ideal question that you'd seek to ask or the answer that you'd be trying to find out?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm very fortunate in the position that I'm in, and that, like you said, we have a lot of resources, both for the actual program, but also there's a strong commitment for our leadership for a robust analytics program, that I am able to have a team that's specifically dedicated to this. But, you know, we still face limitations in resources too. There's limitations in how many randomizations you can do. There's limitations in how many ads a creative team can produce for the sake of research alone. I think that was particularly salient in 2020. Like, we had built over 4 years to win their presidential election and create a Democratic Senate. And so there are limitations in industry around not having your maximum possible treatment effect and having a control group, something like that. Putting that aside, because it's not as relevant for academics, I think the main limitation for us is sample size in measuring persuasion. And the reason I say that is, like I said earlier, you never know who someone's going or who someone voted for. And so you need to either find out via surveys, which are costly, even for a group like us, to conduct enough surveys to measure an impact, or you need to use precinct results aggregated to the zip code or something like that that you can administer treatment at, and then limit your sample size that way to, you know, a couple thousand. And so I don't know if you'll ever fully remove those limitations, but I think by having repeated results and replication over the course of time, that will sort of get at that limitation.
Absolutely. Well, Nick, I think the work you've been doing is super fascinating, and I appreciate you coming on the podcast to share it with us.
Yeah, of course. Looking forward to hopefully more research in the space in the coming years.
I've just been speaking with Nick Ahmed, Director of Analytics at Priorities USA. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm currently putting together the podcast program for the spring, so if you have any suggestions for that list, feel free to get in touch at smnppodcast. Subscribe if you haven't already, and thanks to all who've shared the podcast around. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Elmo. See you next time.